welcome to the first episode of Series 1 of the ESG Factor, brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. This series focuses on the practical integration of environmental, social and governance, or ESG factors, hence the name the ESG Factor. In this series, we'll have in-depth interviews with those working across ESG and equities, bonds, property and hedge funds. And we'll tell you a little bit more about that at the end of this episode. We're starting the series with a conversation between myself and Vincent McCarthy, really about why we ended up collaborating and Vincent's own journey with ESG Ireland. So Vincent, we might start by just giving a very little bit of background about your own experience with investment and then how you ended up moving to Guatemala a couple of years ago.
Great to be here, Eimear. So where do we start? In terms of my investment experience, I actually started as a stockbroker in San Diego. I was lucky enough after university in Limerick, I got a scholarship to go to Fairfield University to a master's in finance. And after Fairfield, I wanted to go somewhere sunny, so I moved to San Diego. And it turned out it was easier to get a job as a stockbroker than as a barman. So I ended up joining a firm, working as a stockbroker, selling individual equities. And actually, one day I was working in the Merrill Lynch building in downtown San Diego. And one of the days coming up in the elevator, the guys from Merrill Lynch heard my Irish accent and said, "You know what? What are you doing here? You should come up and interview with Merrill Lynch." So that led to me interviewing with Merrill Lynch. I spent about 2 years working with them as a financial advisor, and came back then in 2008 to Ireland when everything was falling apart. So my timing isn't great. Maybe I'm a little bit of a jinx. But after working in portfolio management, then I moved into investment consulting, which is very much advising pension schemes, trustee boards, basically, on the design of investment strategy and putting in place an investment offering. And my previous role then, taking this big journey, was as head of investment consulting with a firm out in Sandyford, Invesco. And in April of 2017, it was actually 3 years ago now, I was kind of, it was at the start of the year, and I was thinking, I just turned 35. I was thinking about what kind of challenges I wanted for the years ahead. Was looking around, and to be honest with you, I was 5 years in that role. I was very happy with the people I worked with and stuff like that, but I just had this feeling that I needed a new challenge. So I thought about it, and what I decided was to move to Guatemala. And the reason might sound extreme to some people, but I wanted to first learn Spanish, so I wanted to learn a new language. And then I had this idea, and I was just reading back, because I've written blogs, been writing for over 10 years, so I actually just read back what I wrote in April of 2017, and it was, I'd actually said in it, I've got a meeting arranged with an impact investor in Antigua and Guatemala. So the fact that I've arrived to where I'm at, I suppose it seems a bit random, but when I went to Guatemala, I still had a very clear plan, and it was to try and kind of learn more about impact investing in Latin America.
Brilliant. And we're going to get to the Guatemala piece very, very, very shortly. But I want to get a sense, even in your time in both the States and in Dublin, did you spend much time on ESG investing in those roles? Or was it something that was reasonably new to you when you went to Latin America?
That's a good question. Well, when I started as a stockbroker, it was kind of what you picture in the movies, cold calling and picking up the phone, ringing people about individual equities and individual ideas. So there was most certainly no mention of ESG, but I suppose within my own decision making, I was trying to find companies that I aligned to from a values perspective from the very start, I guess. But no, there would have been absolutely no mention of ESG. In 2006 to 2008, when I was with Merrill Lynch, again, it wouldn't have been something that was talked about much. And even when I came back in Ireland, like, it's still only kind of gathering momentum. There is a lot more talk about it, but in terms of actual integration, we're still early days. So I think the last 3 years, in terms of my own experience, has kind of forced me to kind of think through this in a much more comprehensive way and kind of build conviction behind my own beliefs. I think a lot of the information out there and a lot of the kind of talk around ESG is still at the kind of superficial level, and people are need to go through that kind of philosophical journey and testing their own beliefs to actually arrive at a place that they can materially and practically apply the likes of ESG and responsible investing in general, I think.
Absolutely. And we'll get to the philosophy of it all later on as well. Before we get fully into the Guatemala thing, so you're 35, not a young fella. Not in your early 20s, and you're casting off the cloak of the corporate world to head off to Latin America. What were the view of your colleagues at the time and of your friends and family? Did they think you were mad? You know, did people try to reach out to see if you were okay, or people?
I think I've been referred to as a bit of an alternative character at times. Some people have said restless. I think people took it, like my family would have taken it well. At the same time, even when I was in Guatemala, they would have been wondering, well, that was a big decision. Like, are you sure you made the right decision, you know? Whereas I always had the conviction behind my own decisions. I know people within the company I worked with probably thought this fella's a bit mad, all right? And it would be unusual for them to actually take that type of leap, because you do kind of have to step off the treadmill to a certain extent and kind of move outside the comfort zone, because that's all it is, really. It's like stepping away from a safety net, because you've got a good job. You know, I liked the job I had. I liked the people I was working with. There was no issue there. It was just I felt that I needed to do more. And I suppose, look, it still wasn't a simple decision to make. I had to think it through. But when I thought about it, I said, there's nothing to lose here. Because when I went to Guatemala, I didn't say, you know, the way some people say, I'm going traveling for a year. I went with a clear goal to try and learn Spanish and to learn more about impact investing and emerging markets, because we know very little about emerging markets, even though we have allocations within them. And if after 3 months I wanted to come home, I could come home. So I didn't see it as a massive risk that many others would have seen. Again, you're giving up the comfort of, let's say, an income every month and that kind of stuff. But money isn't the ultimate driver for me, so that didn't really play a big part in my decision making.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of the emerging markets, you know, you made a very good point there that we don't know a lot about emerging markets yet. The concept of emerging markets has been around for decades, if not hundreds of years. So I suppose I have two questions. Firstly, why do you think as a collective Western market, don't know enough about emerging markets? And the second part of that is, I suppose, what are the key takeaways that you learned about the emerging markets while you were over there?
Yeah, that's two really good questions. I think, I think the first is that we tend to live in our own little bubble wherever we are. So even in Ireland, we think we're like the biggest country in the world, even though we're very small in the grand scheme of things, you know. I think that from an investment perspective, in terms of why we don't know a huge amount about emerging markets, is because most of the investment strategy or in our portfolio theory is driven by asset allocation. And asset allocation ultimately says we'll diversify portfolios across a broad range of markets. And that diversification is good, definitely from a perspective of managing downturns in your portfolio, etc. But often what's sacrificed is actually the underlying knowledge of the portfolio. So people tend to say, yeah, we've got an allocation to emerging markets, but they won't really understand too much what's behind the index in terms of the country allocations, or even more what's going on behind in terms of the companies. Never mind what's going on at a local level in terms of policies that are being set across these countries and how these people are living. So I think the biggest takeaway I took from emerging markets and Latin America is that, you know, they have massive challenges. They're facing massive challenges at a societal level. And I think until we have a more informed Western population in terms of the power of our decisions as consumers and investors, it's very hard for those countries to change. And almost our influence is actually almost in a way restricting their development, because it's our policies that are shaping their policies, because our Western model tends to dictate how those countries operate. So that's a major challenge for them. So it was definitely a kind of an eye opener in terms of as well the way of living that in some of these countries, I guess it's pretty tough for a lot of people, you know.
Absolutely. And again, I keep on teasing the philosophy piece, which we will get to by the end of the conversation. But when you have visibility over the and clear, tangible experience about the living conditions of others, it does absolutely shape your philosophy. This podcast is being recorded during the coronavirus pandemic. So Vincent and I were originally supposed to be in the same location for it, but are now socially distanced whilst recording it. But there was an article in The Guardian over the last week that was a letter from Italy, basically a letter from Italy to the UK, where the author made the most succinct point of clarification on that. It's like, this social distancing and social isolating won't be the same for everybody. Within a city, within the world, people are having a variety of experiences, mostly good, but some horrific. And it's been brought out as part of the pandemic, but actually it was always the case. It's something that existed. So, yeah, no, absolutely. When you have visibility and when you have lived in a country that isn't part of the Western world, your viewpoint shifts. So you're in Guatemala, and so you are being diligent and focusing and learning about emerging markets. But you wanted to learn a wee bit of Spanish as well, Vincent? Did you?
I did actually. The Spanish thing was, it turned out that I realized how challenging it is to learn a language. So as well as learning about new cultures, I learned it. You know, a lot of the times we take for granted the people that learn English and the effort that they have to go to actually learn English, because English tends to be the language of business that they're forced to learn it. So I have a new appreciation for all those foreign speakers coming to Ireland to learn English. But you know, it was a great experience. I went the first 3 weeks in Quetzaltenango was the name of the place I was living. It was like a Mayan area of Guatemala up in the hills. I think it's 8,000 feet elevation, so it's a pretty high altitude. And it's very, very Guatemalan. And I was living with a family for the first 3 weeks. So that was an experience in itself as well. And funny enough, after the first like 4 or 5 days, I had to move to another house because one of the young lads in the house wouldn't stop snoring. I swear to God, you couldn't get any sleep. And then going in the next day to try and do 5 hours of Spanish, it was next to impossible. So I was maybe a little bit of a drama queen, but I had to move to another house. And then, you know, 3 weeks came, because initially I said, look, I'll go to Quetzaltenango for 3 weeks and then I'll move down to Antigua. And that was kind of the plan. But I realized, you know what, it was going to be better to stay in the one place to properly learn the language, because after 3 weeks, you're kind of really just scratching the surface. Even after 6 months, you feel like, yeah, I'm making progress. But it does take a lot of time and effort. And as well as that, I think if you're kind of immersed in the community, it gives you, it makes you feel a little bit more comfortable in terms of like learning, because I would have played soccer in Quetzaltenango as well. So it was another kind of avenue to be kind of speaking with the locals, which at the start was next to impossible, like speaking Spanish with the lads on the football team. But as the weeks and months went by, you were getting more and more of it and you were learning, you know, so it was great.
Brilliant. And did you find, I always find sport the most universal language that there is. Did you find that when playing with the locals?
Absolutely. They were unbelievable people. They, again, it's a common language, as you said. They looked after me really well, always made sure, like, if I needed anything, they would be there for me. I broke my finger playing soccer over there, actually, and ended up having to go to hospital, spent the night in hospital. But they were huge, again, a huge help. And it was the same pretty much where I went all over Latin America. I mean, I played soccer on the streets of Cuba with lads over there. Again, you get a sense of their culture, like, down in Buenos Aires where I lived there, I played with a soccer team down there, and you get to really kind of live the experience through those connections, you know. And even when the Spanish wasn't great, you had that kind of sense of connection that kind of kept you together, you know.
Great. That Irish guy who can't kick a ball to save his life, I'm sure, is what the Spanish.
I was definitely the biggest lad on the pitch, I'll tell you that.
Brilliant. So you moved then from Guatemala down into was it straight to Mexico at that point?
Yeah. So basically, well, just to take a step back, in Guatemala was where I did the 4 or 5 months working with the impact investing firm. And then that's basically has been the kind of platform for everything I've done since. So after I met with the impact investing firm in Antigua, Ponema Impact, it was called, that actually led me to Alterna Impact, which was based in Quetzaltenango. So I ended up working there for about 4 months. And effectively, my project was to look at impact investing in Latin America and to develop an investment process for Alterna. And it was a really, really interesting experience. And it was basically, I developed this report, and every week it was a business cultivation team, and we would meet and we would debate out various elements of the report and try to arrive at an investment process. And again, it goes back to what I was saying to you, actually, you have to go through this process to actually have conviction behind the end policy. So it's like investment committees here in Ireland, for instance, would say, well, how do I apply ESG or even impact investing? Some funds have asked me about it. And I say to them, well, you have to go through this process to actually test your beliefs, because if you don't, you're just taking a piece of paper that has 6 principles on it. You haven't actually developed them yourself. You know, you have to ask those tough questions as a trustee board or an investment committee to arrive at where you're at. So, but to answer your question around Mexico, yeah, it was so after that brought me to the end of 2017, and then I went up to Mexico, a place called Mazatlan on the Pacific coast of Mexico, beautiful place. It's in Sinaloa. Anyone who watches Narcos Mexico will probably be familiar with the place, but it's not to be solely connected with that negative stereotype. It's a beautiful place, amazing food, amazing people. And I just kind of wanted a base to kind of get started on my own ideas, you know? So that's where I started working on Cotera Impact, which was to try and get down my own beliefs and my own ideas on paper and then turn it into a website, so that as I went through Latin America, I would have kind of a platform to kind of discuss this stuff with other people in other countries, and also to kind of use it as a platform to think through new ideas. And that's ultimately what led to the founding of ESG Ireland. So it was a process, I suppose, that started in Guatemala and carried through into Mexico.
Brilliant. That's great. I might bring you back a little bit to the impact investment firm. So you talked a little bit about the process that you had in terms of the weekly report and the testing of the principles. But in general, for an impact investment firm, what's that overall structure? What does that type of firm look like?
Yeah, it's really interesting. Well, first of all, I would say impact investing on the ground in the likes of Guatemala and these places is supported by some really good people that have made a decision to move to Guatemala to try and contribute to this thing. So to take the company I worked with, Alterna Impact, it was probably half Guatemala, people from Guatemala, and half people from the rest of the world, United States, Europe, other countries. And they were all from really, really good experience. And again, gave up something that they had in their own country to come down there. So they were all, I suppose, coming with ideas. But at the same time, the whole idea of impact investing hadn't been, and it's still being defined, you know. So we were all kind of coming together with various ideas on what it should look like and trying to arrive at a place that could be practically relevant in a country like Guatemala. So the firm that I was working with, I think they were in operation for about 5 years, but most of the work they had been doing was with social entrepreneurs on the education side. And now at this point in 2017, they were gearing up for new funds coming from the Interdevelopment Bank to actually invest in social entrepreneurs. So that's where it came in, and they were like, you know, you've got great investment experience, maybe you could kind of contribute to this process. And that's how I got involved. And I'd say, I would emphasize that it's the people ultimately that are kind of driving that effort on the ground, because they're not, I mean, I didn't get paid during my time. I didn't do it for money. Most of the people that were working there were either getting paid very low salaries just to be able to support themselves, or there was others doing it for free. And what's interesting is they were getting requests every year, some like 400 or 500 CVs from people who wanted to come down and work in impact investing. So it was really interesting. But I guess where we arrived at was, if you were investing 30,000 to 40,000 in social entrepreneurs, you know, well, one, if you're investing in a startup, you don't have the financials to assess their financial position. That's in all startup investing, right? So then you bring it another level with impact investing. How do you measure their impact when they haven't even started a business yet, or they're only getting started, you know? So I think where we kind of arrived at from what I put forward, I think everyone kind of thought it was a sensible way to look at things, was going back to the kind of stakeholder business model and kind of thinking about impact in terms of how it was relevant to all of the stakeholders, the ultimately the investors, but the community, which is very important in a country like Guatemala, which is ultimately trying to develop, the consumers who are going to be buying it. So we kind of arrived at the stakeholder business model. And then in terms of impact, just like there's a risk and return spectrum, we kind of arrived at a point that there's an impact spectrum. So there will be companies that would apply an impact business model. There would be companies that are tackling social challenges. And then there would be other companies that had transformational products that would deal with a big, big issue, whether it be the environment or society. So I don't think we had a clear position in terms of where we stood in terms of impact, the balance between risk and return and impact. And then I've been in touch with the guys since, and now I think they're on their second fund now. So it really is developing. And certainly my experience with the people I worked with, a lot of the people that were there for the right reasons to actually, you know, to actually deliver a real impact. It wasn't purely driven by a financial motive. Not that there's anything wrong with that, because one of the things that did come out of it was, what is this balance between impact and financial return? And I used to call the business cultivation team, you know, the pragmatists and the dreamers. And in a way, I was a little bit more on the pragmatic side there, whereas I'd be considered more of a dreamer here, you know, because one of the guys I remember in each one of my friends there, he was originally from India, but he worked in corporate finance. And one of his dreams was to set up an impact investing firm in India to solve world poverty, you know. So he had very, very big dreams, which is a good thing. But then on the other side of it, I would say that if impact investing, and this would have been something I said at the time, was that if impact investing was to be taken seriously and they were to bring more capital and make a bigger impact, they didn't want to alienate, I suppose, the traditional financial system either, the investors who are going to be putting money to work. So it was kind of an education process to say, you know what, if you look at it from a sustainability perspective, there is a balance here between delivering sustainable long-term financial returns and actually making an impact at the same time.
Absolutely. And actually that brings me nicely on to something that I've been thinking about as you were talking there. In terms of the investors, like, so it's obviously the stakeholder engagement is a huge part of a program like that, and any program really. But when you think about the investors that you had or that you were cultivating at the time, how many of them were already bought into the idea of ESG? And did you manage to change any? Did you manage to bring any to the table that perhaps weren't as convinced at the start?
Well, in Guatemala, ESG wasn't even really coming into the discussion usually. It was more kind of around pure impact. So the people that would have been putting money up for the fund that Alterna were doing would have been the Interdevelopment Bank. So it would have been, I suppose, a governmental type organization. So we did, one of the things that they did was Alterna, we had a conference every year. They put on a conference for impact investors, and it's one of their biggest achievements, is they've got about 400 or 500 investors and stakeholders in the impact investing sector in Latin America, and some come down from the States as well. And it was in Antigua in November of 2017 when I was with them. And you kind of got a sense of the different types of investors that are out there and their different motives. So I think it's probably anyone that was kind of attending those conferences, they were fairly clued into the idea of impact, but they also saw, I guess, and I, you know, this is the emerging markets, you know, there is huge opportunities there at the same time. So from an investment perspective, they could see that there was opportunities to invest capital in a sensible way down there as well, you know. So you just kind of wanted to find more investors that actually were genuine about their motives, whether you want to say ESG was a framework used to measure the impact or whatever frameworks are applied. All you were kind of looking for is to try and bring more genuine people together that were trying to move this new relatively new concept forward, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then did you notice, I'm going to bring you into Cotera in Mexico now. Was there a difference between Guatemala and Mexico in terms of the stakeholders involved, the approach taken? What were the primary differences, if any?
Well, the best difference from the change from Guatemala was it was nice and sunny in Mexico. But from a Mazatlan is about 350,000 people. So in terms of their economy, it's very much driven by tourism and property. And it's still developing. So you're seeing small little businesses start up. So most of the work really that I did in Mexico was pretty much locking myself away for a certain amount of hours on a daily basis and actually developing my own kind of, I suppose, manifesto in a way to kind of put it out there in terms of my developing the website and kind of what did I want it to look like and what did I really define impact investing as and what did I believe impact should be considered in terms of a business perspective. So a lot of the work I did really in Mexico was more on my own, to be honest with you, and then talking to other stakeholders, like people that I would have worked with in Guatemala, staying tuned in terms of what was developing here in Ireland and other countries as well. But on the ground in terms of Mexico, I was trying to move things forward in a certain way, but it moves very slowly particularly in a city or a town that is kind of more of a tourist driven town than let's say the likes of Querétaro or Mexico City, where there's more of an ecosystem in place. But I am pleased to say that it is starting to take hold, and you are starting to see companies, in small little companies in Mazatlan, developing with a more of a social kind of conscience, really. You know, they are taking this stuff seriously as well.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it again, and to be fair, it must be very difficult when you've mentioned it before in terms of the more extreme poverty, the less developed economy. So sometimes it is just a matter of survival and doing the best you can rather than having a social impact.
Yeah, it is. It's tough, and that's the nature of the emerging markets, because like for guys to start things over there, you know, you're talking about you going in for a business loan in a bank, you're talking about 30-40% interest rates, you know. So to sustain a business through that is very difficult. I mean, one of the things that I did do in Mexico, which I'm proud of, is that I developed an impact center there. So I basically hope that over time it will become a place that will give people a platform to actually develop new ideas. So that's going to, but these things move slowly, and a certain amount of it is providing a platform to develop new ideas, and then a certain amount of it is people need to take the initiative. I've met different people where they say, yeah, I have this idea and I'll do this, and you don't hear from them for months, you know. So I think it's a balance between hopefully trying to provide a little bit of a platform for people to make a difference, and then over time more people will actually take the initiative and actually see that yes, you can. You don't need huge investment to start things. You just need to have the initiative and the drive and a little bit of resource about you.
Brilliant. Tell me a little bit about that business center. What is it?
So my girlfriend is from Mazatlan, so that was my connection to Mazatlan. If people are wondering what was he doing in Mexico in the stronghold of Sinaloa, basically it was a property that we saw that it was in the historic district of Mazatlan, and it was run down. It was a big, decent-sized property. It's like 46 meters long, 5 meters wide. So it's a very long property, and it was in ruins. Effectively, the back was like a jungle. When I actually saw it, because my girlfriend Christina took care of it while I was in Argentina, when I actually got to see the place, I was thinking, "What have I got myself into here?" And that was about August of 2018, because it was just a disaster. But I basically then developed a plan for how I would turn it into something. So we we knocked the second part of the building, and we developed it's effectively the front. You walk in a nice, really nice room, high ceilings, like kind of that old historic look. Then you walk into the next room, we knocked that ceiling, we turned it into a mezzanine office upstairs, and then it's got this high panoramic windows facing onto the patio. The patio opens up into kind of a terrace. You've got the toilets, you've got all nice kind of plants, you've got a nice little bar in the middle of the patio. You got this great kind of pathway that was designed from pallets. Like I met some amazing people. The carpenter, like, you give him an idea and he would just give him the time, give him the idea, he would transform it. And then it leads down, and in the bottom of the patio there's a chessboard. So worked again with the carpenter to put in a big chessboard at the bottom as kind of a stage area where ultimately I would like to see talks going on. So the very last part of the patio then is a small, it's about 6.5 meters by 6 meters by 5 meters room that opens up with kind of this door just opens up. So it opens up into a stage. So the transformation has been huge, and it's been a huge learning experience for me as well, because sometimes, you know, we box people into, oh, you're a financial advisor, or you're a financial analyst, or you're this, you're that. But if you put your mind to anything, you get creative. I think you can do really cool things. And if you work with people that have the skills to take your ideas and actually put them into action, it's the same if it's business or if it's the same as it's construction. That's what you're ultimately doing, working with people that can put those ideas into place. And it literally just got finished just before the end of the year. There's been some workshops held. Christina's a psychologist, so she's held some workshops there for kids. And there's other people expressing an interest to do different things as well. So it's going to be a slow process to kind of build an ecosystem there and get more people involved. But it's one of those things that wasn't driven by profit or financial reasons. It was just, you know what, if anything, if I just take the whole creative process out of it, and actually that transformation from something from literally what looked like kind of a dilapidated jungle to something that is, like, I've had some people come in. We had a party in there for Christmas, and some Americans came in, and one of the ladies, she owned a cleaning business in the Midwest or somewhere, I think it was. And she said, look, I've been to all sorts of houses, but I've never seen somewhere as creative and as cool as this. So that in itself was an achievement for me. So even if I didn't get one more, if it never made any money in the world out of it, I'd get satisfaction out of that.
Brilliant. And we're edging ever closer to the philosophy piece. But actually, what I'm really enjoying is that as this conversation unfolds, your philosophy is becoming all the more clear and apparent through the stories that you're telling. Just one last quick one on the Impact Center. Are there any businesses that are running out of it already, or beginning to set up running out of it?
Well, the main stuff that's gone out of it is Christina's holding some workshops, and there's a few others expressing an interest to put on some workshops. There was two guys who were setting up a business to kind of develop a culinary experience from Mazaclan. So recently they held a dinner there for, I think, 15 people. And it's kind of more, it's not a restaurant, but they want really cool places to put on their kind of culinary experience. So that was something that was put on recently. And at the moment, you know what, everything is just on hold, because like us, they're pretty much locked away as well. So it's one of those things that I kind of wanted to develop organically, in that I'm not going to be putting pressure on people. I share kind of little thoughts and stuff through the Facebook page and stuff like that with people. And if there's, you know, I think it's a case of trying to bring the right people together, and that will take time. So hopefully, when people come to me with an idea, and if I can provide them with the platform to actually to get it started, that will be an achievement. So we'll see how it develops over the next year. I think you talk to me in a year or 18 months from now, we'll see how it goes. But I think longer term, it'll make some small difference, you know.
Absolutely, you know, absolutely will. And really, that's all we can hope for, isn't it? That we leave some small positive legacy in this world. So you as you were walking down through the the Americas. You mentioned that the idea of ESG Ireland and the website was fermenting. So tell me a little bit about ESG Ireland and what your goal is with that.
Yeah. Well, ESG Ireland is ultimately a knowledge centre. So where I see the biggest issues in terms of the integration of ESG across the fiduciary chain, so whether it be at a board level, at executive level, investment consultants, advisors, and trustee boards, and ultimately the end individual, who is the most important, there's a knowledge gap in terms of how to integrate and apply it. So when I was thinking through our ESG Ireland, I kind of saw the big gap in knowledge. And then I said to myself, across this fiduciary chain, what we really need is much more consistency in terms of how ESG is applied. So if a company is applying ESG to improve their sustainability in terms of their company, you would hope that it is then reflected in the investor's decision. So like all this work that they're doing will translate into a stronger investment base, let's say, or a customer base who actually values that stuff. But without knowledge, it's impossible. So you can't expect investors or consumers to fully appreciate the work that a company is doing to change for the better if it's not educated in the right way. So I suppose my goal across it was to improve knowledge levels right across that fiduciary chain, and so that we would have more consistency. So when a company is doing something, people at the end of the chain can actually say, okay, actually, you know what they're doing is genuine, and that's the kind of company I want to be associated, which in turn has a real kind of, it can become, I think, a virtuous cycle, because ultimately, if it is reflected in the investor and consumer decisions, then it will impact cost of capital, and it will have a kind of momentum where companies will start to say, actually, we saw the benefit from that. Now we're going to do even more. And then other companies will see, you know what, our cost of capital has gone up, but their cost of capital has gone down. So we need to start taking this stuff seriously. So ESG Ireland ultimately came about because of that big knowledge gap. And I think it was brought home to me when I came back in December of 2018. That was the end of about 18, 19 months in Latin America. I put on a workshop from Guatemala to the mainstream, considering the impact of your investment. And it was a 4-hour workshop, held it in the Shelburne, mostly trustees attended. And the context was that the IORPS 2 directive was coming in. So basically what it said was ESG would have to be incorporated into the investment process by trustees. But it was obvious that really no one was taking the stuff kind of seriously, or where it was kind of very, very superficial stuff. So that confirmed to me that, right, this is where I need to focus my energy. Impact investing is great, but ultimately right across that responsible investment spectrum, ESG is going to be the framework that people are going to anchor to. And the same with regulators. Regulators need to find a framework, and they're anchoring to ESG. So that really kind of feeds into the consistency across all of the stakeholders. So you have to, ESG is the model. Look, there's still flaws, and there still has to be perfected and so on, but there's a lot of good work there. And I think if people apply ESG with the right mindset and apply it in the right way, in a genuine way, I think it can be of value and it can realize its full potential. Where I see issues like, oh, there isn't enough data, there isn't enough of this, you know, I ultimately come back to the fact that you don't need data or you don't need a model to tell you what's right and wrong, you know. And I think if people look at decision making right across an organization in that way, and if they want to use the lens of environmental, social, and governance, then I think we can actually get somewhere. And in the end, then we will have a lot more data, because we will ultimately have people acting in the right way. You know what I'm saying? So it's almost like people are looking for the data before they make the right decisions. And I think that's almost, in a way, back to front.
That's really great. How are you getting on with different stakeholders? Like, how are you making a mark on the industry with it?
So basically, in May of 2019, so I went back to the drawing board, put together the website esg.ie, put together a pack to discuss it with various stakeholders. And then in May of last year, I started discussing with about 10 to 12 stakeholders, investment managers, some law firms, etc. And, You know what? From the very start, there was a few that said, look, we'll be on board. Aberdeen Standard Investments, immediately when I spoke to them about the idea of an ESG knowledge center, straight away they said, look, we'll be on board, which, you know what? When you're starting something new, if you can just get one firm or one stakeholder involved, it gives you enough of a kind of a momentum or a sense of, okay, I'm on the right path here. So that was a big step. And since then, more stakeholders have come on board. So I think they understand the fact that, look, this knowledge gap is real. And the only way we're going to deal with it is through collaboration and working together. And I think the message I said to firms and various stakeholders is that ESG is where we're going, and it's going to become more and more important in all of our lives in terms of decision making. And it's not a case of in 2 years from now turning on the light switch and saying what your ESG policy is. We have to go through this journey and work together so that in 2 years time, when regulation says no, you can't choose to apply ESG, you have to actually do it this way, that you're much more informed and you can actually use it to its full potential, rather than just saying we're going to slap ESG on this or that and it's not real and it's never going to make real change, you know. So I think from the start there was firms that said, yeah, we like the idea, we'll be on board, and that kind of gave me the momentum to keep going. There was some that, look, again, it's like everything, when you're starting something, you have to take the no's as well. There was people that said, yeah, it's a great idea, but then they go MIA, you know. There was others, one person who I know well and is in the investment consulting side, you know, he said it has a body but no legs and arms. And, you know, so you get those kind of rejections and stuff like that, but you have to be confident in what you're doing is genuine, and there is going to be a real need for it. So since then, we've had a lot more members come on board, more subscribers to ESG.ie. I developed the ESG Factor newsletter. So this quarter will be the third issue, which has got really good feedback. Again, trying to be thought provoking. So the articles are 500-600 words. They're not overly heavy. They're more kind of just, again, getting people thinking about this stuff rather than kind of trying to be overly kind of financial or too heavy that it's going to turn people off. I think we're still in the early stages where we need to actually try and engage people on these issues. I've set up the education arm, the Responsible Investment Institute. So obviously there's an announcement coming soon on the Responsible Investment Advisor course. And here we are today recording the podcast on it. So I think over the course of 6 or 7 months, the momentum has really gathered pace. And, you know, I think that's shown positive signs for where this thing can go. And I think it will be, you know, will be through collaboration and be working with the likes of yourselves and other organizations in Ireland. And over time, it'll just become the standard, I think.
Absolutely. Like one of the reasons why we ended up collaborating is that we both saw the need for bringing greater education and awareness of the agenda to the wider world. But also something that I was always really struck by was your philosophy, Vincent, in terms of it has to be real for people. It has to be practical and it has to be engaging. Like you've mentioned it a couple of times. There's no point in just having something on a piece of paper that's dusted off every now and then. It needs to be really, people need to live it. Is that a fair summation?
It is a fair summation. It's funny the way you say live it, because That is pretty much always kind of been my philosophy. And I think, look, you know, I'm a big soccer fan. I've used this quote before. It's Jurgen Klopp. He said, you can talk about spirit or you can live it. And that is my ultimate philosophy, really. And I think that the problem is that a lot of the stuff around ESG and responsible investing and kind of bringing change is still too much at a superficial level. So I think hopefully we will see a lot more people trying to live it in their decision making and really, really have that conviction. And I think it's a case of not everything has to be perfect, but at least kind of be genuine about what you're trying to do. That would be kind of my message.
Absolutely. And one of the design principles we had for this podcast series was that it would be practical. It would go beyond the press releases and into actually guidelines and tips for people on how to live it, as you say. So do you want to give us an idea of the upcoming episodes that we have?
Exactly what you said is right. The idea behind this podcast was not to sound overly mechanical, I suppose, not to have people on talking about why their fund is the best fund in the world and why their organization is changing the world, or kind of becoming kind of, you know, just something that tends to turn the average individual off. So the objective is to try and produce a podcast that a lot more people outside of finance will be interested in. The people that we have on are going to be people that are at the highest levels of their particular companies with a mandate to incorporate ESG. So we have someone from BlackRock in fixed income responsible for ESG. We have one of the directors at MSCI who's worked on the technical expert group at the European Commission. We have someone from Irish Life, again, trying to understand how do you practically apply ESG from an equity perspective, particularly in a passive environment, because some people would think, okay, ESG is only for active funds. So trying to kind of delve a little bit into their world, and I suppose not provide a platform for it just to be a sales pitch, but at the same time, you know, I think the objective is to try and have an open discussion and get their perspectives, rather than kind of saying you're not doing this right or you're not doing that right. It's really just kind of get the discussion started and to see if from those conversations people can take some practical advice from it. We also have an impact investment manager on from Aberdeen Standard Investments from Scotland. So we've got actually, interestingly enough, maybe it's Corona driven, we've got quite a diverse guest list from various countries, which I think is going to make for an interesting podcast series.
Yeah, it absolutely will. I certainly enjoyed episode one of it, and I'm very much looking forward to the rest of it. So thank you very much, Vincent.
Great. Thanks, Emer. Thanks for listening to another episode of The ESG Factor. If you have any comments or questions on this episode or the show in general, please email theesgfactor@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This series is brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. ESG Ireland is an independent knowledge center focused on delivering thought leadership, education, and the latest developments on ESG in decision making. Find out more by visiting esg.ie or at ESG Ireland on social media. The Institute of Banking is a recognized college of UCD. It's a professional network of over 34,000 individuals working in financial services and is a center of excellence in the provision of specialist education and lifelong learning to the financial services sector. Find out more by visiting iob.ie.